Accession number 18454, Reel 2.
Cyril Snowden, Reel 2.
Yeah. Yeah, we were at Babbacombe for 6 months, and during that time it snowed for 25 minutes because we were so astonished that we timed it, because we were on the cliff top doing all this practice and it happened while we were on the cliff. And we weren't used to snow down there. I mean, it didn't. And so on. And then from there, I went to Cranwell, caps off chaps, to do the wireless course. Because the original idea was that I was going to be a navigator wireless, which suited me, because I was thinking in terms of MOSIs and so on. And I did the full course at Cranwell, got my sparks, and of course by that time I was a navigator who could use a wireless set as well. And then we went to Canada.
Well, excuse me, was your wireless course in 43? 1943, that you were at Cranwell?
Yes, it would be, because, yeah, that's right, because we went to Babbacombe in July 42, August 42, and were there, no, July 42, and were there until February 43, and then we went to Cranwell. So that's, yes, it would be then.
Any specific memories from Cranwell?
Well, apart from the, again, I mean, it was the Holy of Holies in one respect. And the one thing that I remember in particular about Cranwell, and one should keep quiet about this really, the same chap, this friend of mine, as I say, whom I still write to, he was nowhere near as good at Morse as I was, and I took his final Morse test for it. But, you know, and that particularly is one of the things I remember from Cranwell.
Why did you do that?
Because he was scared stiff to do it and thought he was going to fail, and quite likely he probably would, because his speed and regularity were absolutely shocking. So I was good at it, so I took it for him. Shouldn't have done, of course, but there you are.
You were just about to tell me about going to Canada, please.
Yes. Well, we went to Canada after doing the usual toughening up courses. It's now then. There are three places down in the Midlands somewhere, Gamston, Stourgate, and another place. I can't remember its name. But we did sort of commando type courses there. And then after that, we went to Canada. And my one particular memory of going to Canada is that we actually went in the Queen Mary, which of course at that time was the largest ship in the world and held every record you could think of and was a world famous ship. And in fact, it used to go, it used to do this trip regularly, and it used to do it on its own, relying on its speed of about 32, 34 knots to take it through on its own. And we entered New York Harbour in the Queen Mary, and very status that was, you know.
Was it comfortable aboard the Queen Mary?
Oh, yes, very much so. In fact, there were four of us in a cabin that pre-war was for one. And even then, we had bags of room and all the comforts, you know. So what it must have been like for an ordinary civilian passenger pre-war, I just wouldn't like to say. It must have been great. And then we went straight from New York to Moncton, New Brunswick. And that's when things began to really get real. It was also, of course, when we began to realise how big Canada really was, you know, on account of the length of time it took to get from A to B and stuff like that. And then we, Moncton was a sort of a distribution point, really. And we all went off on our various courses from Moncton. And we went to Port Albert in Ontario to do our full navigation course and navigational flying as well, of course, which of course included lots of map reading and things like that, which we needed, believe me, we needed, again, because of the distances between the places. And the only place at Port Albert which you could call a civilization of a sort was Goderich, which was the local town about 6-8 miles away from Port Albert station. And then we went from there to Picton to do, oh yeah, but sorry, by that time they'd changed the requirements a bit in the RAF, and the navigators wireless were being turned into bomb aimers because they had enough navigators wireless, you see. And we went to Picton, also in Ontario, to do our bombing and gunnery course. And then we went from there to London, Ontario, to do the final navigation course, and in fact the rounding out course, and the passing out parade there. And then we came home in 1944.
How did you cope with the bomb aiming course at Picton?
Apparently well. In fact, so well that my crew set a group bombing record on one particular trip, which there was a group competition on at that time, and we won the competition with my bomb aiming, and we thought there might be some comments or mention or compliments or whatever about this. Not a word. So we just ended up finishing our course as the crew that broke the bomb aiming record, you know. And then, as I say, we went from there to London, Ontario, to finish off. While we were in London, still with this friend of mine, and this is where it becomes a little bit sort of interesting in a different direction, I introduced him to a London girl whom he actually married after the war in England. She came to England for them to get married, and then went back to London to live in a house that her godparents had given to her. And they lived there for, well, right until she died. And she died about 10 years ago. And I'm afraid at that point my friend cracked. And he's now somewhat in the Alzheimer's situation. But as I say, we still write to one another. And then, while we were there, and he came with me to do it, I bought an engagement ring, because of course, if you wanted an engagement ring in England, you had to have either a second-hand one, or unless you could play, you know, really pay the earth, there was really no choice, whatever.
During the war?
During the war, yeah. And so I deliberately bought a ring because I knew what size my wife's ring finger was, because a ring fitting on her engagement finger fitted my little finger exactly. So all I had to do was to look for a ring which fitted my little finger. And when I brought it home, at first she didn't like it, but then all her friends started to go balmy about this thing, and she did like it then. So there you go. And then we got engaged, and I carried on with my training, as it were, finishing off at just outside Belfast.
Eglinton?
Pardon?
Eglinton?
No. It was on Belfast Lough.
Antrim?
No. It was Bishop's Court, that was it, Bishop's Court. And we finished off there, and then from there we were brought back to England, and then we started to crew up.
If I could just stop you there, what was the quality of training like in Canada?
Extremely good, I thought.
Was it by Canadians or by English?
Both. In fact, it was by Australians and South Africans and all kinds of people. It was simply people who were qualified in that particular speciality, whatever it was. And they were all in one air force or the other, you know. And
was it a good place to train?
Very. Except it wasn't, we found out when we eventually got to the squadron, it wasn't such a good place because we were used to the wide open spaces. And of course, going on ops, there weren't wide open spaces. So you had to sort of contract your navigation and map reading bit.
I think you were just about to tell me about crewing up in England, please.
Yeah, well, we crewed up, and from there we went to our squadrons. And my crew was a real British mixture. I say British advisedly. The skipper was from Romford and was a trainee accountant. The navigator was a chap who was a medical student following a long family tradition. His great-grandfather, grandfather and father were all doctors. So obviously he was going to become a doctor. And obviously also he was known to us for that reason as Doc, of course. He was from Liverpool. The flight engineer was from Shrewsbury, and his father was an Air Commodore, caps off chaps. But he was simply one of the boys. The wireless op was from Wishaw in Lanarkshire, and he was also an amateur Scottish weightlifting champion as well, and looked like it. The the mid of a gunner was from Cardiff via Manchester. And I say that deliberately, because he regarded himself as Welsh. But our rear gunner, who was a mate of his, said he wasn't a real Welshman, because the rear gunner came from the Rhondda. And we never found out exactly where he came from, simply because it was one of those Welsh village names in four parts, and not one of us could get our tongues round it. So we never knew the name of the place he came. All we know is that he came from the Rhondda. And if you let him start talking about either Welsh male voice choirs or Welsh rugby, you couldn't get a word in edgeways. But that was the bunch. And the thing about Taff was that he deliberately disciplined himself to talk plain English when we were on ops. Deliberately, for obvious reasons. I mean, he was no good in talking his brand of English Welsh and trying to give the skipper instructions when he couldn't understand what the devil he was saying. And he deliberately taught himself to speak plain English on ops, which is very, very good. And it did come in handy once or twice. But, and that was it. That was the crew.
What was the name of the pilot?
Russell. Gordon Russell. And he, and I say, he came from Romford. And the one thing that annoys me and disappoints me is the fact that I have tried several times to trace the members of my crew over the years, and I've never succeeded. The only one who I know, and I do know where he is now, is our Welshman via Manchester, because when my wife, my new wife, and I went down to Bury St. Edmunds to the Angel Hotel for our honeymoon, he'd been married about 6 months, and his wife had gone down in the hopes of seeing him while he was on the squadron, and she stayed at the Angel as well. She and my wife, who were both called Joan, hit it off together, became really friendly, and wrote to each other right until my wife died. And she and he still send, like I do, Christmas cards every year and so forth. So I know that he's in Cardiff and so forth. But I've never been able to trace any of the other crew at all, despite putting adverts in what I can think as their local papers. And of course, there again, being a librarian, I had the resources to find out what paper would be done for so-and-so, you know what I mean? And not a word. And this Cardiff via Manchester lad, as I say, my wife and his wife were good friends, I wrote and told him when I found out that we did have a squadron association, because I didn't know we had, and he didn't even reply. So, there you are.
Now, can you take me a bit further from the crewing up, please?
Yeah, sure. We went to... now then. Woolfox Lodge, which was a con unit, onto Heavies. And when we finished there, we were posted to our squadrons. And this is where this chap, as I said, I still contact, who was now got Alzheimer's disease, was the first time we'd been split. Because he and his crew had all been... Well, they brought all the members together and left it to them to pick out the people who they fancied working with and so forth at the same place. So when we got our squadron postings, that was the first time he and I had been sent to different stations throughout our career in the Air Force. And it struck me at the time, and it still does, a typical services matter. He came from Clevedon in Somerset. So obviously, the best place to post him was Lincolnshire. So he was sent to a squadron in Lincolnshire. I came from here. So the best place to post me was to a squadron down in Suffolk. Yeah.
Which squadron did you go to?
218, Gold Coast Squadron. And that's its full name, 218 the Gold Coast Squadron, because it was paid for by what was then the Gold Coast.
What? When did you go to that squadron, do you think?
At the beginning of 1945. Right at the beginning. Because as I say, I was... You know, I know it was a long time training, but the thing is, the training was lengthened with this change of direction by the authorities, which put us onto different courses, which made we were training longer. Do you know what I mean? And on the squadron, well, I mean, from 218 itself, in my time, was based at Chedborough in Suffolk, which is about 8 miles from Bury St Edmunds. And our satellite drone, if I remember that was the correct term, was Stradishaw. Because we always knew them as Ched and Strad. And I was there until the end of the European War, because our last few ops were on Operation Manor, which you've probably heard about. Yeah. Well, we did those. And oddly enough, those... I've forgotten most of the ops, because an op is an op is an op kind of thing, you know. They were just ruddy noisy, lots of flashes and guns and things, and, you know, one ran into the other type thing. But the manor ops, I shall never forget those as long as I live, because, well, as you know, I mean, we flew on routes supplied through the International Red Cross by the Germans. If you got outside that corridor, you were in trouble. You could get shot at and so on. But the thing that has always stuck in my mind is the sight of people on the, because of course obviously we did it in daylight at low level, the sight of people on the ground going like this,
waving to you.
Yeah, we used Epenburg as the dropping place, dropping zone, you see, and that stuck in my mind. All these people and children sort of scattered around the the dropping zone area, all waving. And the strange thing is, you may know this, the Dutch the Dutch have always made a big thing of the Operation Manna job, because in the 50th anniversary year, again, there was a tremendous setup organised in Holland. And our squadron secretary, squadron association secretary, tried to organise a trip, because our squadron was on it, you know. Unfortunately, she only got 5 firm names, so we had to scrub round it, because we were going to this 50th anniversary of Manna set up, and we weren't able to, which is a great pity. But I know the Dutch still make a great deal of it. And the thing that connects that with Epenburg Airport and these people waving is that we all made each crew, well, we did anyway, made sort of a homemade parachute, small one, and put our flying rations in this thing with a message attached, "Voor het kinder," which meant, of course, for the children. The point being that the younger children there in Holland had never seen sweets in their lives, you see. So, of course, there weren't any during the war. And we did this, and the Manna trips have stuck in my mind all my life because of that.
Had peace been declared by then?
Pardon?
This was after VE Day, was it?
No, it hadn't. The war hadn't finished, but Holland was occupied by the Germans. But the war was coming to an end, and the Jerrys knew that they weren't going to get anywhere, you know. And so it was a vast organisation to get this thing arranged, you know, obviously. And we dropped supplies of food and so forth to occupied Holland at these sites which were named and routes given to us by the Germans, and you know, and that after that, it was odd, really. We did those, and then eventually